Okay, so we might as well get going. The grades are on your blackboard, or not blackboard, canvas, right? And double check your test that you have, and the answers we went over in class, Tuesday, right? But your versions are up here too, 2A and 2B. They're PDF versions, and they have the right answers. You know, look at the dot next to the answers, so you can double check, count up how many you got right or wrong, make sure that it adds up to be the right number. When the Scantron people gave it back to us, they counted. They didn't count 48 as one of the questions, and so they didn't count how many right. But so I added back the point, and then you know multiplied everything by two. So the number that you missed, for example, you multiply that by two, and you could subtract it from a whole 106 points, or just the multiple choice, which was at 48, right? And then you had 10 or 46, and then you had. No, it was 48, right? And then you had 10 points for the open response. So on Canvas, it says the 10 points out of open response and out of 96 for the multiple choice. Or just add the ones you got right, multiply it by 2, and that number should match the number that's on Canvas. If there's any discrepancy, they did provide that electronically. They didn't give paper. They're trying to cut down on paper. How many questions you missed and which ones you missed. So if you want to send me an email, I can bounce that to you if you want to double check. Or I could print them all out, and then we could hand back that, which ones you missed, if you want. Whatever you want to do. And then we have the Scantrons, and if you think there's any script on the Scantrons, I can take a picture of the Scantron, email that to you, and you can double check as well. Like if erasing errors or something like that. Okay, so definitely. Now, if those scores are right, it wasn't as high as I thought. So I guess, was it? I didn't mean for this to be hard, but I guess it was harder than expected. Is that definitely? Everybody's always going to say that no matter what, right? So we will try to make some easy quizzes coming up. Remember, we have two more quizzes. When's the next quiz?
Tuesday.
And then when's the next quiz?
The next Tuesday.
The next Tuesday. Because what happens on Thursday, I'm not here, but you can wonderfully hear my voice that I will pre-record for Echo 360. On Thursday, we do not have class next week. Yay, break, right? But you'll still have a whole wonderful hour and 10 minutes of a lecture to listen to sometime down the line. So what I'm trying to do is to get through the material so we can spend the dead week time actually reviewing a lot. And that will help you, I think, too, right? So what I'm trying to do is to get through this material so we can go over it, answer questions, because we don't have a lab that week, so I can't torture you with, you know, all the last 3 hours again. But what we can do is use lecture time, hopefully, to get through everything and go through reviews, right, for the final to make it less stressful.
Those two questions that you said were kind of borderline, if we missed them, can we talk to you about that? Or just like
save them and see where you are. But I'm still kind of wondering about that stroke volume one, because that's, actually, you know, that stroke volume one, in case you weren't here. So, and I don't know if it was you I emailed or whoever I emailed. They had questions about the stroke volume and distensibility of the ventricle for Frank Starling. If you take a little heart from a little person, what kind of stroke volume do they have? Versus a big person with a bigger heart, they got a bigger stroke volume, right? So it's not really stroke volume, it's that stretching of the ventricle. But if you took an individual person and maybe you looked over that individual person, if stroke volume is really how much it pumps out. So it's really the reserve, it's how much the ventricle fills up, if you wanted to, you know, get to the nitty-gritties and stuff. But I don't want to confuse anybody, I don't want to, it's not meant to be tricky. But I do think if you had a better answer, you want to use the better answer than you know what you would have. So that's kind of where we're. What was the other question that was? Can't remember.
It was the sarcomere one. Where it was like the tension of it, where it looked like it was overlapping.
It was overlapping, but and the graph does show it. But you know, what I want to do is have some buffer in there. So we'll see where we are with these things. I'm not trying to bring the average down. I wish the average would be a 90 on all the exams, but. I didn't realize that was going to be that challenging. So anyway, it was, I guess. So we'll see what happens. Definitely double check the numbers on there. You know, physically I have to enter them in too, so there's always a human issue. Okay, so to recap, your grades are on, your old exams are on the webpage. right? And you got two PDF versions there. Check the PDF versions. Go through it. Count up your scores. Make sure it all adds up. And then some cool things. Are you on Science Daily yet? Everybody should be on Science Daily. There were some really cool things that came out in Science Daily where they're actually taking these people with spinal injuries and that don't have a sensation in their hands and actually putting sensory things on their arms so they can actually then electrically excite that sensory cortex so they have feelings like where their hands are where they normally don't have any control. That's pretty cool.
That's what was on Science Daily about finding the protein for the Alzheimer's.
Cool.
That causes Alzheimer's in human cells. And start to figure out how to grow neurons and remove the protein.
That would be really neat. Wow. That might help me. I think I'm getting Alzheimer's. That's really neat. So the Science Daily is really cool because it just gets you really stimulated every day when you look at it about new breakthroughs, and it kind of encourages you to keep studying, you know, going on. And there's just kind of fun things. I mean, too, the measuring activity in a bat that's flying around if you want to look at neural activity and things like that. It's a phenomenal site to look over. Okay, so we are moving a little quick with content, and you know, that's why it's good to come to class, kind of. And we're going to try to wrap through respiratory on Tuesday. I hope we can get to a little bit of osmo maybe before we finish, but we'll come back to some of that as we go along. Remember, we're on respiration, gas exchange, right? And then we're going to get on to osmoregulation, ion balance, and ion exchange. So we went through some of the aspects with barometric pressure at high altitude and how you would measure barometric pressure. So we need to make sure that we understand that. You might get a problem like that. But also you think about altitude. This is where we left off. At high altitude, the barometric pressure changes. It drops with going up to altitude. And so that means your partial pressure of oxygen drops. So you wonder about how does a bird fly over the Himalayas when there's so little oxygen, right? And they can do this. And you wonder, what's different about them? Do they have more hemoglobin? Do they have, you know, a higher hematocrit, RBCs, right? Can they handle a drop in pH more? You know, what's going on with these animals if they're not getting as much oxygen? And there are issues with humans, for example, that live... They've actually looked at those people I mentioned at Leadville, Colorado, for example, where the highest continental USA, where people live throughout the year. And there's lots of issues with the people up there. For example, they tended to use coal-burning stoves or wood-burning stoves to heat their place. And some of them are kind of like a little bit more outdoors type. And our lumber people that go around and work with the lumber companies are just choose to live at this high altitude for whatever reason. But they've actually looked at some people that have grown up at high altitudes, like in South America and the Andes. And what would you expect physically of these kind of people? If you were living at high altitude with low oxygen, how do you get more oxygen in your lungs?
Be smaller.
Maybe be smaller, right? Might have an effect on development issues because you're not getting the oxygenation. And you can actually do that with animals. You can raise even Drosophila in low oxygen and they will not grow as well, right? But it depends on, you know, that where that level is. Any other aspects? How do you, if you're low in oxygen, you're running in here and you're trying to get more oxygen because you don't want to be late to class, what do? You breathe heavy, right? So if you had lower oxygen, if you went to high altitude, what would happen to your breathing rate, do you think? Go up. And would you inhale more air every breath, probably? Deeper breathing, right? So what do you expect with the lung development?
Larger
lungs. So those people are more barrel-chested, and they've actually looked at the dynamics here. So you have more barrel-chested, larger lung. So would, normally, if you're at high altitude, would tidal volume increase, probably, for a person that's going to higher altitude? Yes, right? And maybe even your vital capacity, because you have a larger lung, right? So this is that integration that we have to think about. I mean, we can memorize, you know, the tidal volume thing and vital capacity, and we'll go through that. But then, like what you're doing in lab, right, this week. But then think about that in relationship to, say, a person living up at high altitude or growing up at high altitude for a long time. And there are these problems that we mentioned that can happen, and it's not always one way. If you go to high altitude and you have low oxygen, you actually stimulate erythropoietin, which comes from where? Erythropoietin, review, kidney, and liver. And what does it do?
Red blood cells.
Goes to the bone marrow, makes red blood cells, and increases your hematocrit. People that go to high altitude for short term, for example, they might start to get a higher hematocrit. And usually that's associated with sickness at high altitude. Some people that go to high altitude do not increase their red blood cells, and usually they do not get as sick. So it's kind of interesting, this compensation, and it's called, if you ever hear this, Mengele's disease. There's some really cool books, as I mentioned before, for people going up to high altitude, like the Mount Everest teams, and written a number of different books by physicians and researchers on how they condition themselves and taking blood samples and all this kind of stuff. It's really quite cool. All right, so try to integrate content, and that's what we're going to try to keep reviewing throughout the time. So now you also think about animals, like we talked about, that are in salt water versus, you know, fresh water, a freshwater invertebrate versus a saltwater invertebrate, and they're down in the bottom of the lake or the bottom of the ocean. What's the problem here? Let's integrate. Salt water has more solubility of oxygen or less solubility of oxygen?
Less.
And then fresh water, right? And now, as we go deeper in the water, it's probably less turning over, right? Depending if there's ocean currents that are turning it over, like the Atlantic current that comes or from Antarctic that turns over. But in a lake, a lot of times, it's stagnant at the bottom, right? And it's quite hypoxic can be down there. And plus you have detritus that falls in and things like this. So it's really quite interesting if you look at the different environments and the different animals and you wonder how they live. Okay, so where else did we go with this? And so salinity, oxygen solubility, altitude, and this is how we would calculate. We mentioned this. So you want to remember how to calculate partial pressure of gases, the barometric pressure times the percent of whatever that gas is. So you could do one for nitrogen, right? Now that you know what this is, you know, on an estimate, let's say maybe 80% oxygen for nitrogen, for example. But when you talk about the air going into the lungs, that moisture takes away some of the barometric pressure. So we subtract generally about 18 or minus 20 if you want to measure the barometric, the partial pressure of the gas in the alveolar sac, right, down in the lungs. Okay. Some other aspects. Diving, right? So how about the barometric pressure for these animals if they're diving and you think about the solubility? So depth in meters. And here's ambient pressure. You see that the pressure goes up, right? With a diving animal, for example. And you look at PO2, and you look here. Well, the barometric pressure is higher, but we have to think about, is there enough oxygen there, right? So that's the issues. And then nitrogen. So nitrogen really goes up, too, with depth. So what's anybody ever do scuba diving or maybe just had fun on some cruise or something? Was it in the Caribbean? Was it in the lake? Or in the coral reef, yeah. So sea level pretty much, and then down, not too deep, 100 meters?
Yeah,
or something. And back there?
Fresh water.
In a higher altitude or level?
Low altitude.
You see, and some of these problems are that people go out with a scuba team, are they're saying, oh, let's go scuba diving, and they go over to Carter Lake, for example. Well, what's the problem with Carter Lake? It's not at sea level. It's at a higher level. And so it changes the barometric pressures. But what are the tables usually used for that you get from the U.S. Navy, for example, the diving tables? They're at the sea level, and they don't, you know, you have to compensate. So people get in trouble because they're at high altitude already, and then they're using a diving table that was made for ocean, and then they end up in issues. So what's the other issue if you're diving and all of a sudden you saw that barracuda and you got scared? What would you do? And you wanted to go up really fast. You got, you know, nervous. And you got the bends. Do you know what the bends are?
It's like, isn't it oxygen that's like gas in blood?
Yes. Yes. So, did they like teach you in scuba diving? You always go up the slowest bubble that you can blow, and you try not to go. And sometimes these, if you wanted really good jobs, we knew students in Texas, for example, when I was an undergraduate student, they would make great money in the summer. I mean, really good money working on oil fields in the ocean, right, in the Gulf of Texas, and they would get a welding certificate, and they would help weld on these rigs. The problem is they would usually end up having some problems. Usually lung problems are the bends. And so when you get the bends, this is a common problem with scuba divers, is that they dive down, right, and you're in compressed gas. Well, let's just say you hold your breath and you do a snorkel dive. If you hold your breath, take a big breath, and dive down, and you're going to go with that shell that you see down there, what's the issue? So the pressure is building up. It's kind of collapsing your lungs, right? But you had that air that you breathed in outside. And then let's say you held your breath and you didn't blow out, really, and then you start to surface. Well, the pressure goes away from you, and your lungs start to expand back. But they're going to go back to where they were to begin with. Now take compressed gas in a tank that you have in your back, and you're breathing in and out. And now you're down deep, 100 meters down, and you take a nice deep breath, and you fill up your lungs, and you get scared, you saw the barracuda, and you shot up to the surface. What just happened? You filled up your lungs down below, and now as you surface, there's less pressure on you, so your lungs expand more, and then you blow it right out your mouth. So some of these people die right away when they surface, because they just blow their lungs right on out, and they're dead. They can't be rescued. Now, if it's not so bad, and they started to come up little by little, and they throw out their compressed gases. The other issue is having to stage yourself when you come out from a deep dive. What are you doing? It's like what you just said. The solubility of nitrogen is high. So you build up a lot of nitrogen. And nitrogen will go into your adipose tissue, in your muscle, in your brain. And so you've got these little gas bubbles that are inside of your tissues. And then you start to surface. Well, what happened to the pressure around those little bubbles? They decreased. So they're going to get bigger. Unless you have time to breathe and get it exchanged out of your tissue, like your adipose tissue and your muscle and your brain, then what's going to happen to those bubbles? They get bigger and bigger. So people that surface too quickly and don't decompress as they go up, those bubbles get bigger and bigger. And it's like the plastic wrap that you wrap things in, you know, little bubbles that you want to push. They say it sounds like that all over their body, that these little bubbles are popping all over. And if they pop in muscles or in your brain, guess what damage it causes, right? So what did they have to do to these people? Take them to a decompression chamber, right? And put them back in deep pressure, let them breathe it out. But what's the problem if you're out in the Caribbean somewhere and you went on one of those little Caribbean cruises and they give you 5 minutes of instruction about scuba diving and you don't really pay attention that well, right? And you're not certified. They get in trouble all the time. But you sign a waiver that you're not going to sue them. But if you look at the incidence of case problems with scuba diving, it's very high on those kind of cruises and things because they don't train you well enough and you're not certified to really go through this. And so what did they used to do? They used to take these people, like on those cruises, and they get into problem. Well, they don't have a decompression chamber on the cruise ship. So what do they do? They'll, you know, medvac you on a helicopter. Now what happened? They just took you up into higher altitude, and what happens to barometric pressure when you go up to altitude? Decreases. So you just made it much worse. So what they actually do now is these oil rigs have decompression chambers on them. And they actually use them for the public too, in these tourist groups. And they'll try to fly the helicopter right over to an oil rig, not too high up, and put you in a decompression chamber and decompress you. And so these oil companies are actually helping out with some of the tourist groups. It's really wild. Because it's soluble, it's very soluble into adipose tissue, into your muscles and your brain, and that little bubble, when you were down below taking in compressed gas, it goes into those tissues, and then if you surface too quickly, the bubble gets bigger. Okay? And so it's called nitrogen narcosis. Nitrogen narcosis are the bends. It's the same thing. And so it's usually a problem with nitrogen, getting it out. So this is why they have those, you might see in those National Geographic movies, they have a rope going down, they have tanks tied to the rope, so they can decompress for so many minutes at different levels,
So good scuba divers know all about that good stuff. Okay, so it's kind of interesting to put it all in context. It's a real problem, right? And so it's kind of an issue, and now you understand why that's a problem out in the real world, right? So some real issues that we have to study about. So that's kind of neat to think about. Okay, and then we know about hemoglobin, right? And remember from very early on, hemoglobin, not just one heme, but hemoglobin itself is a, what kind of structure? Primary, secondary, tertiary?
Quaternary.
Quaternary structure, right. And so a quaternary structure because it has four globular domains for our hemoglobin, mammalian hemoglobin, but an individual heme is like this with iron. Myoglobin in your muscle, oxygen binding affinity, that's a single heme, so it is more or less a tertiary structure. Okay, so it's interesting in us, in mammals, that we go through different forms of hemoglobin. We have fetal hemoglobin, and we kind of imagine why, we talked about that, and even embryonic form of hemoglobin, because as an embryo developing, you've got to pull that oxygen off the mother, right? So your hemoglobin needs to be stronger as a fetus growing up to pull that oxygen out of the mother so you can have it. But you don't want that high binding affinity after parturition, after you're out of the mother, because then it binds too strong. You need to get it off, too, right? It needs to be a trade-off. You need to get that oxygen off so it can go into your tissue beds, right? So you don't want it bound so strong that you can't get it off throughout adult life. And so some people actually have problems. They don't get rid of their fetal hemoglobin after birth, and they actually end up with being a problem about getting good oxygenation to the tissue. So there's disorders with this, or you maybe don't develop the adult forms. So there's that transition after you're born, and it's pretty interesting to think about. But the main point is, the take home here is that you have different forms of hemoglobin as a fetus, as an embryo, a fetus, and your adult life, and you change over. If you kept the fetal form or embryonic form, you've got some issues later and after you're born. Okay. So you can see this is called an oxygen dissociation curve. It has appeared on standardized exams. There's multiple things to know about this type of curve. So let's just go through it. You might see it again. It was on old exams, too. PO2, we now know how to calculate this, right? Partial pressure of oxygen, low to high. And then you have percent oxygen saturation. Now, this is a little bit different. This isn't oxygen content. This is percent saturation. So how would you think to even measure percent oxygenation of hemoglobin? How are you going to measure this percent oxygenation of hemoglobin? I think experimental designs are really cool when you go back in history and think about how they measured it. Yeah, now you can do that kind of. That gives you your percent oxygen saturation. That's right. I'm thinking before they invented these nice little things, my generation, is that they actually put blood into a glass jar, and if anybody has rock tumbling and rock polishing, you know, that roll around a long time, they actually put it into a glass jar, sealed up, with little ports that they can take in, and they put in different PO2s of oxygen, and then they take the blood sample out, and they can measure percent saturation. So it's kind of interesting. It's called a tenometer. We were forced to do that in a physiology lab, and so actually, you see how lucky you are, just put it on your finger nowadays. And so that's kind of neat. So percent saturation, it doesn't tell you the hematocrit, it doesn't tell you how much blood you have, it just says saturation of the blood that's there, right? And so you would go up to 100% and then kind of backtrack your graph. But what's really neat about this graph, too, is it's not just straight up. It has a somewhat sigmoidal shape, right? And that sigmoidal shape is where they test you on standardized exams. So the sigmoidal shape is important because the more oxygen it binds, the more percent saturation you get until you kind of reach this plateau. So the sigmoidal shape is due to cooperativity. And the key word is cooperativity. One oxygen binds, the next one binds at a greater affinity. It's kind of like when we went back to, I know, you've purged it all already, synaptotagmin that binds calcium, there's four binding domains, and they think that that's actually cooperativity binding too. One calcium binds, the next one binds better, and you can add up and get synaptic facilitation, for example. Okay, so if you think of the myoglobin being a single unit, it only has one binding, you know, spot, compared to hemoglobin that has four, then myoglobin doesn't show that cooperativity, so it's more or less a very straight line going up, and then it saturates, right? But it has a greater binding affinity. So the way to work out these binding affinities, when you have to do something on a test later, is you take one particular value of PO2, go up, and then come across, and look, hemoglobin, only 40% saturated at 30 PO2, right? So you go up. It's only 40. But what about myoglobin? Go up, go over, it's, you know, almost 90% saturated. So which one has the better binding affinity at a given PO2? Myoglobin, right? So this is the way to work that out. And why this is important later is that we want to look at different conditions like acid-base issues on hemoglobin. So these diagrams are really quite interesting to work out. And so if you look at now the issues of your blood as it circulates through your body, what happens? In your lungs, you have high oxygen, right? And you're blowing off CO2. So what happens to pH in your lungs? And the blood going through, if you're blowing off CO2, it's going to go higher. So it's more basic. Now you go down to the skeletal muscle, and you're exercising, you're producing CO2. A lot of CO2 is going to drop the pH. Well, how does that change binding affinity on hemoglobin? So in the muscle bed, you decreased, right? You did and this is the type of standardized questions you'll see on standardized exams, right? It'll be a right shift or a left shift. Left shift. And does that increase binding affinity or decrease binding affinity? So if it's a right shift, lower pH, what did it do to your binding affinity of hemoglobin? Choose a particular value. Right? So did it increase or decrease?
Decrease.
And that's what you would want, too, right? Exercising skeletal muscle, you want oxygen to come off of hemoglobin going to the muscle. So you see, it kind of makes sense. And you go up to the lungs and you blow off CO2, it's more basic. What do you want to do? You want to grab hemoglobin and put it on, you want to grab oxygen and put it onto hemoglobin. So in that basic environment, you get a better binding affinity so you can grab it. So it all kind of makes sense. Temperature is the same way as well. So a higher temperature, exercising skeletal muscle, raise the temperature, you decrease the binding affinity of hemoglobin. So it all, see, very logical in that sense. So you don't have to memorize things, just kind of think about the logic behind it. It's pretty neat. So that's that curve, and you can see the values of pH and values of saturation and related with CO2 that's also present. So this is important to understand, and there's some extra slides in here just to kind of give you some general aspects. And depending on which textbook you use, there's some corrections that we have to think about. So this is an important graph to kind of get the idea of understanding your lungs and that circulation that we just talked about. You just visualized it. Skeletal muscle, I would just use the tissue cell of skeletal muscle and see what's happening. CO2 builds up more from the skeletal muscle because the byproducts, right? And you need to get that off in the lungs. So it all makes sense. What's interesting about hemoglobin, too, let's go back to that Leadville, Colorado situation, right? High altitude, higher hematocrit. But when you, and the spleen can actually break down red blood cells, right? That's part of getting rid of their old red blood cells, about 120 days survival. What happens when you break down heme, though, the hemoglobin, one of the byproducts, which is just bizarre, is carbon monoxide. Is that not weird? Carbon monoxide is a byproduct of breaking down heme. Well, what happens with carbon monoxide poisoning? It will actually displace that oxygen. It binds about 200 or 210 times stronger than oxygen to hemoglobin. So if you're displacing that oxygen, you can't get oxygen to your tissues, right? Because you now have carbon monoxide. That's why carbon monoxide is so dangerous, right? And carbon monoxide from coal stoves, from wood-burning stoves. But now think of that guy, these guys up, or gals, whoever, people, up at high altitude using a wood-burning stove that's getting more carbon monoxide in their atmosphere around them. Plus, there may be a smoker on top of that. That could really be bad, right? And then their hematocrit's higher, and they're turning over their hematocrit, you know, red blood cells, and they got more carbon monoxide from smoking, the wood-burning stove, and the turnover of red blood cells. They're in a bad situation, right, in that sense. So it's kind of interesting to think about. And smokers, you do get more carbon monoxide.
So did you say that carbon monoxide replaces oxygen as
as a binding to hemoglobin. So it's really 200 times stronger. So you get just a little carbon monoxide, you can really have some issues. And that's why, you know, people put their exhaust pipe into their car window. You've seen those in the movies. Very bad because you can't smell carbon monoxide, right? So it's an issue. Okay. So why do we use the partial pressures? You can go through this. I would test you on why the difference with Fick's law. That's back to your other stuff. But the idea is that partial pressures, people ask that usually many times. Why not just use concentrations? It's very hard to use the concentrations to try to relate to the barometric pressure as well. So this is why partial pressures are used. It's a lot more standard. The issue is if you try to use concentration, you really don't get a good appreciation of the barometric pressure having an influence on solubility or adding to the effect of gases going into the solution. So partial pressure, just to take home, partial pressure is a lot easier to manage and understand than trying to deal with concentrations of a gas in the solution. And one textbook goes into more depth about this than the other, but the main idea is how to calculate partial pressure. Okay, then you think about different animals with different ways to get gas exchange. We kind of talked about this. Amphibians, a lot through their skin, right? And they might even have lungs, like a frog, but they can also do a very good exchange through their skin. So what would you expect for respiratory structure as a small animal versus larger animals, right? They need to get more oxygen in their body, their surface area. So if you actually map the surface area of the lungs of mammals, you could look at small mammals to large mammals like an elephant, and you're going to see that curve go way up for these animals because the surface area is so great, and like a giraffe or an elephant in their lungs, because the lungs are so large and that increased surface area is just tremendous to try to get good oxygenation. And the same with invertebrates if you look at the structure of the gills and you look at the activity of that animal. The more activity of these type of species, you'll see a bigger respiratory structure, a larger gill surface. So it all makes sense. And that's kind of the fungi-wizzy part. And we talked about simple animals that really can just have oxygen diffused across, like a planaria, for example, and then more complex animals that would really need lungs and bring air in and out because they can't get it across their surface of their membrane. And you think about this animal, like a salamander, you know, their gills are external here, and you see them, they look pretty nice, but very vulnerable for being damaged, right? And their soft tissue and the capillary beds, you know, need to be close by the exchange system. So this is actually very easily damaged, which then could deplete that animal of oxygenation. So internalizing lungs, get them inside a protective environment, is pretty good, and that's what you see throughout the animals. And even like your crayfish, you see the gills are not outside, they're underneath the shell, right? They're inside the cuticle to protect those soft structures. So kind of interesting to think about. So we can go through gee-whizzy pictures. But the way that we breathe, we go in this dead sac, right, and then out that dead sac. Maybe not the most efficient way for breathing, but when you have to get a big surface area, it works pretty well in that case. Let's look at a few different ways of breathing. So there's this blow-through system, where water, air can just blow through over the surface, respiratory surface, or maybe you're like breathing in and out like we do. And, you know, the advantages of water versus air, what's the disadvantage of water? You've got to get solubility in there, right? And we talked about temperature of the water already. We talked about salts of the water being a factor, right? Fresh water is better than seawater. And so those are things to think about for the advantages and disadvantages. Air breathing generally stays the same at, you know, where that animal is, unless they're going up to high altitude and going down to low altitude, like maybe a bird trying to fly over the Himalayas. All right. So those general points. And we talk about amphibians and reptiles. And we talk about being very delicate surfaces, right, for your lungs or respiratory structure. You don't want it to be really thick. Think about how many membranes gas would have to go through if it's in your alveolar sac. Let's just think about that. Gas comes in, oxygen molecule, what does it have to do? It's inside your lungs. It has to go through the cell layer of your lungs, right? So it's going across the cell membrane to get into that maybe first epithelial cell. Then it's going across that, you know, through it, through the cytoplasm, right? And then through the membrane on the other side. And now it's inside the blood, right? So it went through two membranes already, one cell, but one side to the other side, so two membranes. And then what did it do? It got into the blood, but now it needs to get into the red blood cell. So now it's going into the red blood cell, right? But it had to go across something before it got to the red blood cell. It had to go through the capillary bed, right? It had to go through the capillary cell. So now you've got a cell in the alveolar sac. You've got a little space between that. And now you have the epithelial cell of your capillary bed. And then you get into the blood. And then you get into the RBC. So now let's see how many cells did it go through. Went through one cell in your alveolar sac, two membranes. Went through some space. Maybe there's fluid in there, maybe it's not, maybe it's pretty close, but still had another membrane in your epithelial cell in your capillary bed. Had to go through that, had to go through that membrane. So two cells there just to get into the blood, and then the RBC. So I had to go through three cells, in membrane, 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 and then one membrane into your RBC. Sometimes we've seen old standardized exams actually go through that scenario, and they had how many cells did it have to go through, and how many membranes did it have to go through? So just to kind of make you think about it, but always draw something out on an exam, right? It helps you instead of jumping and forgetting something. Okay. So flow-through systems where water can just go right through, or air can just go right through. Structures, actually your crayfish have a little, it's not just a simple, coming through like this. There's actually, if you look at the long part of a crayfish or a lobster, there's actually an organ in the front of them, and they pull the water through their back legs. There's a base right there, holes. The water comes through their back legs, and in the front of the animal, there's a special respiratory organ called a sphagnomastoid. Don't worry about spelling this thing. We just call it a ventilatory organ. And it beats. It's like a little blade. And that water comes over the gills, and if this little blade is beating and pumping water out, the water goes in front of the animal, pulls it over the gills. You decrease the oxygenation in the water, guess what? That ventilatory structure starts beating faster, and the water flows even faster. So these animals are sensitive to the oxygenation in the water. Lower animals like fish and crustaceans, they actually are more sensitive to hypoxia than they are the pH. But we're more sensitive to pH, right? Because you hold your breath, put the pulse ox on your finger, and what did we learn the first time we did that? The pulse ox didn't really change. It was still at 98, but you had to breathe. And that's because the CO2 is increasing, and your pH is dropping, and your carotid, what is detecting that? Carotid's
bodies,
and aortic bodies, because pressures for your sinuses, they can detect that CO2 or low pH and cause you to increase your breathing. If we talked about COPD, didn't we, a little bit, I think a long time ago? COPD patients or people that have COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder, mucus in there, usually from smoking, Kentucky. Hey, we're right up there with West Virginia. We're known for something one or two. There we are, COPD incidences. And the issue is that they're having a hard time getting oxygenation into their body. They are actually functioning at a lower pH than a normal person. They can handle a lower pH. So if they went to an ER and they measured their blood pH, they said, oh my gosh, this guy, they got low pH. It's a real issue. So what's the problem here? Well, and then if they're not getting good oxygenation, what might they do? Put the gas mask on and get oxygenation, right? Is that the question?
Yeah, I was
going to ask that. Yeah, so what do? They put oxygen on them. And there was a study, I think I mentioned this early at the beginning of class, actually where the EMS workers caused more harm than good by giving people oxygenation right away to getting them to the ER, for example. And the reason was because they're less sensitive to pH, that's not the problem. They're more sensitive to hypoxia, and that's keeping them to breathe. So the hypoxia is keeping them breathing. So if you give them oxygen, what have you done to hypoxia? You eliminated that hypoxia. But if the hypoxia is increasing their breathing, what have you done? Decrease their breathing, So now what happens to CO2 in their lungs, in their body? It's increasing because they're not blowing it out. So you've actually made the pH worse and caused arrhythmias in the heart and problems. So giving oxygen to somebody you don't know where they are or their sensitivity to oxygen versus pH, you could actually be doing more harm than good to the person. So EMS magazine about 2 years ago actually showed the cases where they were causing more problems by the time they got to the ER by putting an oxygen mask on.
That's only under hypoxic conditions.
Pardon?
That's only under hypoxic conditions.
Yeah, it's usually with chronic obstructive pulmonary disorders. So they've reconditioned their body, basically, to be more hypoxic sensitive. And so that's kind of interesting that you have this redundant system. You decrease your pH sensitivity, and then you become more oxygen sensitive. And those are in your aortic bodies as well. That's kind of interesting.
So that's a pH issue.
Well, so if you could function at a lower pH.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now you're more sensitive to oxygen. Hypoxia will drive you. Yeah, right? And you have PO2 sensitivity in your body. You can detect that level.
So it's an innate, like,
lower pH. And it's thought that it actually was a precursor in simpler organisms, like we just said, that these animals are more sensitive to oxygen than they are pH. So that's kind of interesting. And then you look at diving animals, like a diving seal or a diving whale, they can actually handle a much lower pH for a longer period of time and seem to have no real effects. And their oxygen levels, CO2 levels, are actually higher. So it's actually kind of interesting when we look at diving animals as a comparison too. So we can talk a little bit more about that. So it's kind of interesting. You do have O2 receptors as well, but you generally aren't using those in normal function. You're using pH and CO2.
You just said a question about going through the different membranes, various membranes of the lung as a test question. Is that going to be one again?
We're getting there. I'm just trying, preluding you. Okay. But you could imagine what it has to go through, right? Okay. All right. So, you know, driving, breathing, we have respiratory muscles. What happens with a person with COPD, you could imagine, or somebody at high altitude? They're breathing, their lungs barrel-chested. But if somebody's really struggling, they use accessory muscles. The accessory muscles are in your neck. So try to breathe in really hard and feel your neck. And which muscles? You're feeling these muscles on the side, right? The sternocleidomastoid muscles, actually. They actually will, if somebody that has COPD, you'll usually see these muscles enlarge, and they'll have these thick muscles on the side of their body, because you can already tell by looking at them that they're using accessory muscles for breathing. And they've been using it over time, so that muscle's going to exercise, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and that's somebody that you can say, hey, he's probably got an issue. So, tidal flow is really quite interesting. Some animals breathe by ram ventilation. So ram ventilation, like sharks, if you keep some sharks still, they will actually die. They can't breathe well. They have to ram ventilate, called ram ventilation, push the water over their gills. So they're always swimming. Go to Newport Aquarium, the Atlanta Aquarium, fantastic. We should take a field trip. It's just awesome thing to do if you go down there. They have these sharks swimming around all the time, and you wonder why they're swimming around all the time. They have to. They're going to suffocate if they don't, right? Because they're ram ventilators. So they have to ram ventilate. Other animals, like some of the fish that you might have caught or seen, they have opercula. And it's kind of like that crayfish scenario. They can use these opercula and move them back and forth. And actually that pulls water over their gills, right? So here, they can actually use that. So you got like ram ventilators, ones that actually have muscles that can move the fluid over, like a fish with their operculum. So that's kind of neat to think about. So it depends on which animal you're talking about. But what's really neat is in these gills in many animals is that the water flow that goes across, or in birds, a similar situation that we can talk about the bird lung later, is that water flow, or whatever's carrying the oxygen, is countercurrent to the blood flow. So blood flow goes this way, and the fluid, the media, goes the other way. So why is that so important? Well, countercurrent flow gives you a much better exchange of the gases. So countercurrent flow, think of the flow of, it doesn't matter which side, well, here, PO2 of, say, the gas or the water, you know, coming across as it's exchanging with the blood that's coming across, that's low, that just came from the systemic circulation, low PO2 because it's just delivered the oxygen to the tissue. But what's happening? It can keep exchanging the gas because this is lower than this, partial pressure. So it can keep exchanging. Now, as it keeps exchanging, it's getting less and less of a gradient. But look at the gradient here. It can still be lower gradient here than here at the end of this exchange system. Look at the concurrent flow where they're both going the same direction. Now what do we have here? You know, blood coming in, our O2 and alveolar sac, and you actually see that the exchange is balanced out and we're not getting as good of an exchange still going through the whole system. It's going to equal out quicker and we don't get as much PO2, we don't get as much partial pressure of oxygen into the circulatory structure that goes across. So take home message, countercurrent flow is more efficient than a concurrent flow. And the animals that use this get a better oxygenation in their blood. Okay? Okay, so that's kind of cool. Oh my God. I forgot to plug that thing in. I know. You're hoping. There, rescued. All right. Okay. So we've talked about RAM ventilators. These are kind of just put in there to help you think about it. And we think about viscous solution, right? Water, more viscous than air. So this is an issue, too, to get that across. Air, very easy to get across the respiratory structure. There's just some really weird structures in arthropods called the book lung, because it looks like a book, right? Layers. But what is this doing? No different than the gills or in our respiratory structure. Increasing the surface area. Getting that surface area as large as possible for the blood to go across in whatever the media is, water or air. So some animals have what's like these spiders have what's called book lungs, and you see a little muscle here that can actually go back and forth and help pump air across. Isn't that cool? So they got some really neat types of systems. Arthropods, like insects, they have spiracles, so they don't actually need the blood for oxygen transport. That's kind of interesting, because they can get gas exchanged right down to the tissue. They have spiracles, these holes that could be either at the head region or at the tail region. If you had genetics, you probably played with Drosophila larvae maybe, and you could see the little spiracles sticking out the behind them, and they can bring air in, and those trachea go right down to the skeletal muscle. And so when the animal's moving, they can actually get exchange right at the skeletal muscle by their trachea. And they don't need hemoglobin. They don't need the type of respiratory pigments that we think of with other animals that are carrying it through their circulatory system. So it's pretty interesting just to kind of get the idea. We've talked about the general points here with amphibians already. Amphibians can not only cross their skin, have a good circulatory system, but it has to stay moist. That's the issue. It can't be a dry skin. It doesn't get a good exchange, right? That dead space is difficult. So moist skin, like our lungs too, moist to keep it functioning, right? So the cells can easily get the gas across. Some animals can use lungs as well as the skin. Mostly, like amphibians, will use skin for a good exchange too. But these animals actually force oxygen or air into their lungs by closing their mouth. They like swallow the air. So it's kind of interesting. And then we get to reptiles and more advanced animals, like what you're interested in. And, you know, breathing and causing that respiration structure, like the lungs, to fill up with air. So diaphragms, if you look through the different types of lungs, you'll see that simple ones like the salamander, onto the amphibians, and up to the mammals. So pretty neat. And then the point about the mammals is that we have these little sacs down there called these alveolar sacs. This is where the gas exchange takes place. It doesn't take place in the bronchi or the terminal bronchi. It takes place in these little sacs called alveolar sacs. So if we look at these are kind of interesting. Big surface area, right? And you know, the general idea is what you can think of trachea, bronchi, bronchioles, and then the terminal bronchioles go into the alveolar. So test questions in the past have been, where does gas exchange take place? In a mammal, alveolar region, those alveolar sacs, like little grapes, big surface area. So it's kind of neat. So this is, you have to get that air in, and then get the air out, but we've got a very strong vascularization, right, through our lungs. The whole right side of the heart is pumping through the lungs, right? And then it comes into the left side, right? So if you remember that circulation. So think of all that blood. But in our lungs, unlike this horse that's standing here, our lungs, we're standing up like this. So we generally perfuse the lower part of our lungs with blood. If you exercise, your blood pressure goes up and you start perfusing more surface area. That's kind of neat. But also, think about blood's going to go through faster because why? Your heart rate has increased. So now think back at the exchange. What happened with the capillary bed and gas going across? If you go too fast, you can't get good exchange. So just having the lungs 100% perfused at rest, and then you increased heart rate, there's going to be an issue. Because it might go through so fast, you're not getting good gas exchange. So what's kind of neat is that you can perfuse more of your lungs, and also increase the rate going through, but you've increased a greater surface area. And that's what happens when you start to breathe faster, and your heart rate goes up, and you're like exercising.
So I imply, like, when they say, well, like when you exercise and like your chest hurts, and like when they say you're not getting enough oxygen.
Well, if you're,
not
so much. You might not have been using your external muscles so much, and it's kind of like if you never ran and then all of a sudden you run, your muscles hurt.
Yeah.
We don't use our intercostal muscles that much at just the standard movements, but if you're exercising, you will be using your other muscles instead of just your diaphragmatic muscles. Yeah, those aren't your muscles. So we just need to exercise all the time.
Keep them in shape.
All right. So the idea here, alveolar sac, very vascular. If you have a damage to your lungs, like a wound, for example, you can bleed out pretty quickly, right, because it's so highly vascularized. Okay, so types of alveolar cells and types of these cells that are inside the alveolar sac. I hate to, you know, say you have to memorize things all the time, but the reason I bring this up is that HIDES appeared on standardized exams too, and I know the majority of you are interested in standardized exams. So they do make a difference of types of alveolar cells on standardized exams, type 2 and type 1. Type 2 is really interesting because it makes surfactant. Surfactant is like soap bubbles. So if you took water and you added soap, what happens? You see the bubbles. It decreased the surface tension. So the idea is that it decreases surface tension so you can pull cells apart easier. This is the problem with preemies, babies born too early. They haven't been able to make surfactant, so their alveolar sacs are kind of stuck together, and it's hard for them to open up their alveolar sacs. So preemies sometimes have to be on a pressurized gas. It depends, you know, the situation. So they know it pretty much standardized the time of birth. If it's too early, the lungs haven't finished developing. They're not going to get good oxygenation. You need to get the sacs open. Or sometimes they'll actually perfuse into the baby a surfactant. They'll put it into the baby's lungs to decrease the surface tension. So it's kind of interesting to think about. And they know, you know, when they have to do these kind of different things. So alveolar ones are more or less the single type of alveolar cells that are in there. But the key is alveolar two make pulmonary surfactants. And why is this important too? You have different sized alveolar sacs. It's really good in this one figure. And this is why I use this text because it helps a little bit. Let's go down to... I think I removed it. Okay, so the thing to think about here is that these, if you had a smaller alveolar sac and a bigger one, actually it's going to, this pressure is going to try to fill the other one. But having equal surfactant, it takes away that capillary, that surface pressure or surface tension, and so you can get good gas exchange to smaller alveolar sacs as well as bigger ones, and one's not going to collapse over the other. That's the general idea behind it, to decrease the surface tension so you don't collapse your alveolar sacs. And if they do get touching together, like inside the alveolar sacs collapses, you can open it up easier. Some diving animals, like a diving whale, it's really interesting, the ones that can stay down an hour, they actually collapse their lungs. They can get all the air out that they're using. They don't have any more nitrogen buildup. They actually blew it out, blowing up, and they can completely collapse their lungs. That's pretty cool. But they're not going to have gas sitting in there you know, like nitrogen building up and getting into their tissues. And then they can, when they breathe in, it all fills up. So you can imagine they probably have a good amount of surfactant, right? Because they need to get that tissue to open up again. So it's really interesting, small diving animals for a shorter period of time versus large diving animals that can go down a long time, differences in the way that they've compensated for this aspect. Pores of pond have been used on standardized exams. If you take another class or anatomy, they'll test you on these things. These are just air flows that go between alveolar sacs, if you will, or different regions of the respiratory structure. It's just a pore, like a channel, that can allow air to go between cells. And maybe there's a picture of this thing somewhere. Okay, so let's think about breathing. For us, mammals, how do we breathe normally? Just your tidal volume. What's your tidal volume about? Yeah, an average person, 70 kilograms, you know, some type, 5'7", or whatever it is. What's your general tidal volume? 5,000 liters, 5 liters, 500 milliliters, a half a liter, right? Breathing in and out. So just a half a liter. You start to exercise, it becomes more, right? Because you're filling up your lungs. So how is it that we're breathing with tidal volume just at rest? Mostly diaphragmatic, so you might say a diaphragmatic breather. So how is it that your diaphragm causes you to breathe? Well, think of a closed box. I used to have one. I left it at some school, and I can't remember where I left it. If you had a box, right, in this plastic box, all right, so visualize this. This will help you. And you tied a balloon, and you sealed the balloon off to the top of this plastic box, okay? And you got a balloon sitting in here now. At the bottom of your box, you have a rubber plate in the bottom, okay? And then now that balloon has got, you know, hole to the atmosphere. But on the bottom of that box, you take that rubber plate and you pull down on it. What happened to the pressure inside the box? It became negative, right? So what happens to the balloon? It's going to fill up. That's how your lungs work with diaphragm breathing, okay? Now, if you're exercising and you're using accessory muscles, what else adds to this? Well, if we expand the box on the sides, what's that going to do to the pressure inside if we pull it out, right? That's going to make it negative. That's what your intercostal muscles do in your ribs. External versus internal intercostal muscles. External, the way to remember this, external takes in external air. External air. So if you use your external intercostals, it's pulling the sides of the box out. It lifts your ribs up. It lifts your rib cages up. It can then now make a more negative pressure inside your thoracic cavity, around your lungs, and open up your lungs. Now, if you have, and you're breathing really fast, you can actually use your intercostal muscles to help collapse your lung, to help collapse your rib cage. So internal intercostal muscles collapse your rib cage, help pull it down, and it's going to get internal air out, right? Because now you're pushing in on the box. So hopefully that scenario, you'll have that down, you won't forget it, you've got those answers on the test, right? Okay, so that's the way you use it. But generally, you have this general elastic recoil of your lungs, right? I mean, of your rib cage. So if you tried to use your external intercostals and pull them up, and then just don't use your internal and just relax, what happens to your rib cage? It pulls down, right? So it's going to help exhale air without having to use energy. But if you're COPD, you got fluid built up in your lungs, what are you doing for energy? You're trying to get all that blood across, your heart rate's up, and what's going to happen to your metabolism? It needs to go higher, so you need to eat more, and you can imagine then the care that's needed.
Are you saying it's like an accordion?
Kind of, yes, exactly, you know, in a sense. Just, but I'm trying to visualize that box, but definitely. Pulling it up, make a negative pressure, air goes in, close it down, pushes air out. So it's the same idea in your lungs, and that's how you function. So we just went through that. Your diaphragm's not working. You've got an issue, right? Birds. The only thing I really want you to, I don't want you to go through all this different memory work in the birds, but the one thing that is different is that it's really quite neat. They have this interesting structure. They have air sacs. They can pull air into these, exchange. But the real exchange of gas with the circulatory system occurs in the parabronchi. the parabronchius. So they can have these air sacs, they can collapse these down and force air over the parabronchi. This is like the gills for a fish are like our alveolar sacs. But it's these tubes that run across with blood going the other direction, countercurrent exchange. And so it's kind of neat. So it's the parabronchi that are important, not the air sacs for gas exchange. Okay, so lots of neat things with this. All right, so we've kind of gone through that. Air versus alveolar sacs. We talked about the countercurrent exchange is really important. And we talked about, you know, skin for amphibians, non-respiratory structures. I'm not worried about that so much. We're going to talk about some other things about how you measure gas, but I'm not interested in the speaking part. Okay. So we just went through this whole figure and understanding how your lungs work. So there's a couple figures on this about the diaphragm pulling down, making a negative pressure in here that then allows the lungs to fill in. And when you relax, the diaphragm kind of bounces back because it's like this rubber plate. It's going to push back up, make a positive pressure around the lungs, and then push air out. Okay, so that's all these figures are basically going through that, which we just went through to try to understand. And we talked about COPD and the problem with COPD. Okay, and here's this point about surfactant. We already know what it is now. It decreases surface tension to allow those to fill up well and not collapse. Okay, so we don't have to worry about those numbers. We do want to know generally these figures because you had a lab on this, right? You went through this lab. So you do want to understand the general values here and some terms to kind of remember for a human. Tidal volume is about 500 mils. How do you measure these other values? Breathing in, deep breath, inspiratory reserve volume. So when you breathe in, you can take in more air, right? If you forcefully exhale, you know, as much as you can, contract down on your external, internal intercostals, and you force air out, then that's the expiratory reserve volume. So it's not, you know, you might think it's a lot to memorize, but it's really not so bad. You've got tidal volume, you've got inspiratory, you've got expiratory, and then if you take the total of that, what is that? That's vital capacity. It's the total amount that you can take in, right? But you cannot empty your lungs. You have a residual volume that's in your lungs. So how would you measure residual volume? How do they do this in the clinics, for example, if you wanted to measure residual volume? And it's important because maybe it tells you you're not utilizing all your capacity. What would you think? It's a neat experiment. People came up with this and it's like, wow, that's so cool how they thought of doing this. You breathe in, you breathe out, but if you wanted to measure your residual volume, what could you do? You want to measure maybe what might be diluted in there. So they used to use substances that they could measure, like helium or radioactivity at one time, but that was bad, they found out. But you can measure something that you could actually measure when you breathe back out. So you just have a normal breathing, but now you're breathing in something that's going to be diluted with your residual volume. Hold your breath a bit. That's not going to be absorbed in your blood. And then blow out. Now you've got a dilution. So you can easily figure it out. N1B1 equals N2B2. Remember all the chemistry stuff? Okay, it all comes back to haunt you. So they just measure dilution factor, and you could actually measure residual volume. That's pretty neat. All right. It depends on the textbook you're using. If you're using this textbook, there were some issues in there, so I made sure that we have these corrected things. You know, functional reserve. This is just goes with that table that we were showing. And this was just to show you that, you know, different animals have bigger volumes that they can breathe, like an elephant. 47 liters per breath. Can you imagine 47 liters? You know, it's something else. 5 breaths a minute is a relatively low breathing rate, but a large volume, right? So kind of neat. And this is that dead space that we... Dead space is where you don't have exchange, like in your trachea, right? And you did the dead space by increasing dead space, basically with that long tube. So how far can you go down, or how long can that snorkel be when you're going, you know, just kind of around on the water and looking at neat things on the Caribbean, right? Is if your snorkel's too long, what's happening? You can't get the air exchange, right? So then you can't get your CO2 out and you can't get fresh oxygen. So there's a limit to that snorkel length. So the point of that lab was to try to understand that snorkel length. And, you know, that increase in the dead space is a problem because you don't have gas exchange in that spot. Okay, so that's the take-home of that. And we've already gone through this. All right. And okay, so this table, this figure, I would definitely star it because this is really important to go through, and you can kind of go through this aspect here, but it makes really good sense. Some values you should try to remember. About PO2, about 100 partial pressure in the alveolar sac, right? About 100. What's that doing? That's the pressure to push oxygen into the blood. Oxygen in the blood, generally, that finishes going around the systemic circulation, is about 40 in your arterial side going to your lung bed. And then what's it going to do? Pick up oxygen. Does it pick up all the way? You know, it picks up a pretty good amount, almost at 100 again. This figure is right at 100. And then what happens to CO2? CO2 is higher as it comes along here, and when it gets to the lungs, it's high on the arterial side, but it's low on the venous side. Remember, that's kind of confusing because it's the lungs versus the skeletal muscle. And then that CO2 goes out, and then you have lower CO2 on the other side. So 46 to like 40, right? So try to get these general ideas down. What's happening down at, say, a skeletal muscle? Well, we're getting oxygen in as we use it up. CO2 is being produced, and that's now driving it into the blood. The thing to remember about CO2 is most of CO2 in your body is not carried as a gas form. It's carried as bicarb. So bicarb is your primary transport of CO2, bicarbonate. Remember that TEP2 that we talked about? CO2 plus water goes to what? Hydrogen ion plus bicarb, right? So most of your CO2 in your body is carried by bicarb. And that reaction reverses itself when it gets to the lungs, because now you have that enzyme, carbonic anhydrase, in your lungs as well. So that's converting it the other way. All right, we'll go through that over and over again. So this is kind of generalized information. We talked about hemoglobin. Other animals use different types of hemocytes, different groups, like your, and you don't have to memorize all the different types, but the idea is that you have different forms of hemoglobin. Your crayfish, for example, use hemocyanin. It actually uses, instead of iron as a metal, like iron in us, hemoglobin, they use copper. And it's kind of blue. When it's really oxygenated, it's blue. And so that's kind of neat for crustaceans. And there's different forms. You might eat some annelids, it's actually green in color as the respiratory pigment. So there's some neat aspects. We talked about hemoglobin already. But four oxygens per hemoglobin. The text made it a problem in this textbook. So four oxygens per hemoglobin. So it's O2 oxygen. O2, not just one oxygen molecule. Okay. So, and we talked about oxygen dissociation curves. So the difference of, if it goes to the right, is that increased oxygen affinity or decreased oxygen affinity? Is it rightward shift, decreasing oxygen affinity? Decreases. Leftward shift, increases oxygen affinity. Okay. So that's the main point there. And we've talked about these different factors like pH, acidity. We talked about temperature. One other thing is 2-3 DPG is actually in most mammals, and it can change your oxygen affinity as well. And it can be changed by going to altitude, for example. So no rightward shift or leftward shift. So rightward shift, increase CO2. Think of skeletal muscle. Increase CO2, increase hydrogen ion or low pH, increase temperature, and then just increase the other one too, 2-3 PG. All these increases make a rightward shift. All right? So that's the way to remember that. And then there are two factors with hemoglobin dissociation that we should know for standardized. One's called the Bohr effect. That's related with pH. The other one is the where the rightward shift, basically, this Bohr effect shifts it to the right. But to decrease the total percent of saturation, it's called a root shift. Okay? So the root shift decreases the total oxygen content that you can carry. Now, this is content. This is different than saturation. This is content, right? So it gets confusing sometimes. So this content, you decrease the content that you can carry. That's the root shift. The Bohr effect is shifting it to the right. Then low pH shifts it to the right. Right? So decreasing the total amount of oxygen you can bind versus the saturation to the rightward shift. Okay, so I know that can be a little confusing, but you know, try to get that down because those two terms have appeared on standardized exams too.
And the root shift goes up or down?
Well, it can go either way. It just it depends if you're increasing it, you know, like a lower pH decreases the affinity, but it also decreases the total amount of oxygen.
Okay,
so low pH, high hydrogen ion, decreases the total amount of oxygen you can bond. That's the root shift. And it decreases saturation. So it's the Bohr shift to the right. So no right-left shift. You've got to know those terms, how that affects oxygen. The equation that you want to get your tattoo with, 10 points extra? No, I'm joking. Okay, so, but we should know this. And I'm going to have to end here in a second. I thought I was going to get into some osmoregulation. We didn't quite get to that. But we have scheduled, we're almost done with this chapter. Almost there. But there's a little bit more to this. But I thought I was going to get into some of these respiratory alkalosis and acidosis. I didn't get to that yet. So I won't cover that on the quiz. Right? We'll cover what we covered before. But on Tuesday next week, we were going to have a guest speaker in that actually works with Justin Fraser, the neurosurgeon here, where they remove clots and they measure blood on both sides of the clot. I'll see if she might be able to come the following Tuesday. Remember, we have no class on Thursday, because then we can cover a little bit more and her talk would make more sense, right? Because she's actually going to talk about differences in pH and osmoregulation. But if she doesn't come then, if she comes next Tuesday, I will send you an email and then just some things that we should kind of know for her presentation. Yeah, we have a quiz on Tuesday too. So, okay. If you didn't get your exam, come on up and get your exams.